Well, hello there, and welcome to episode number 73 of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Many thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you use. Remember, if you haven't already, consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which amounts to over 70 conversations so far. That archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. Indeed, included in the deal is the book that we discuss in this very episode. If you do become a member, you'll have my sincere gratitude and most importantly, you'll be helping us develop the podcast. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or by doing a quick Google search or by looking at any of the other podcast pages. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on with our latest episode, in which we speak to Nazlı Alimen, the author of Faith and Fashion in Turkey, Consumption, Politics and Islamic Identities, which is published by IB Taurus. The book examines how religious dress in Turkey has been reflected over decades, and it's based on extensive on-the-ground research with members of various Sunni religious communities in the country, the Süleymancis, the Menzils, and the Gülen movement, who are of course now persona non grata in Turkey. Alimen looks at how religious attire has been politicized and not politicized over the years, different practices in private and public spaces, the relationship between the marketplace and religion, and the increasingly prominent conservative fashion market in Turkey. Much of the book obviously focuses on women's headscarves, which we discuss later in the conversation, but I started by asking Nazlı Alimen to talk about what triggered her interest in the subject in the first place.
The book is based on my PhD thesis because I was doing my MBA and I was interested in consumer research and consumer culture studies. And I came across several works on Islamist women in Turkey. And I was thinking there are not only Islamist women, because when you say Islamist, you are referring to people who support political Islam, but there are also Muslim women, practicing Muslim women who cover their heads, but they are not followers of political Islam. So I wanted to extend these studies and also include those women who are not necessarily the followers of political Islam. In addition, I was also thinking, because the Islamic rules of clothing and modesty don't cover women solely, but also include men. And I wanted to include men. I wanted to examine how they interpret and follow those rules, those Islamic rules, and how the gender relations in between, how these things work, especially in such a patriarchal culture as in the Turkish context. We are always discussing women's clothing, women's headwear. We neglect to talk about Muslim men's appearances. This is politically and patriarchally a power structure when we are just talking about women and what they should wear, what they should not wear. I just wanted to broaden this discussion and look at it in a different way.
The book is based on a lot of kind of first-hand interviews and research with dozens of informants, really. And obviously, this is quite an intimate or sensitive area to be probing. Did you have any particular difficulties gaining people's trust or making people open up to you while you were doing the research?
Well, when I did my research, it was a very good timing because previously, and also since July 15th, 2016, after the attempted coup, religious groups do not want to be reached out and they are suspicious of others. And it was the same case previously, especially during the 28th February 1997. They were suspicious about others, especially like secular looking people. But I started reaching them in 2012, and it was the 10th year of the AKP government. So they were open. So it was not very much difficult for me to reach them, especially when I, through my key informants. Of course, if I went to them directly, if I just said, okay, I'm doing this research, would you like to have an interview with me? Then definitely it would be difficult because they could think like probably I come from a secular newspaper and sort of trying to create a kind of scandal. But through my key informants, I was able to reach people. So in terms of timing, I was very lucky. But in terms of gender, because there is this gender regime, gender relations in the Islamic environment. For example, a man, according to the Islamic rules, a man cannot stay alone with a woman who is not his mahram, which means like first degree relative or like cousin, nephew, and so on, or his wife. Outside of this, he shouldn't stay in a segregated area alone with a woman. So this could be one hesitation for them. In this case, again, my key informants were very helpful. I had a close friend, a male friend, who was a gatekeeper for me, introduced me to members from those three religious groups. And they also joined the interviews when it was necessary, when I was interviewing some male members of those religious groups. So the timing was good, and also my gatekeepers are important. But now it would be almost impossible to interview members of religious groups, especially Gulenist people, obviously.
Now, taking a kind of historical look now, one of the key figures in women's clothing that your book kind of references is this character, Shule Yüksel Şener. And she was, yes, a writer who rose to prominence as a columnist in the 1960s. And she was also, yes, a novelist, actually, as the writer of Huzur Sokağı, which has become a kind of classic novel among conservatives in Turkey. And she was crucial in shaping ideas of the new kind of urban, modern Islamic headscarf. And it's, yes, style that she kind of pioneered in a way that we still recognize today. And you actually write that it was inspired by Audrey Hepburn's way of wearing a scarf in the film Roman Holiday. And this kind of new headscarf style was seen as new and unique and presented the wearer very consciously as kind of more educated in a way, sort of more urban, yes, and also more consciously religious is a key word there, consciousness. Could you just talk a bit about Şener and, you know, generally how that style of headscarf was new, how it was important?
We cannot really certainly say that headscarf is because of the religion. When we look at traditional Turkish society, especially, let's say, before the 1980s, when consumer culture was not as much proliferated in society as it is now. So women would traditionally cover their hair, especially after marriage, for example, or in rural areas, in villages, girls reaching a certain age, reaching puberty, they would start covering their hair. Or when they go to fields to work, they cover their hair. And the discussion has been in the literature that starting from the 1970s and 1980s, especially with the spread of political Islam in Turkey, women started learning about religion because they claimed that, okay, their mothers, grandmothers wore the headscarf in that style or this style, but they did not necessarily know about the religion. They just learned it from their relatives, from their parents, grandparents, and so on. But they didn't actually sit and read the books, religious texts, and discuss how these need to be interpreted and adopted. So when we look at Şule Yüksel Şener, yes, it was in the 1960s, and she was influenced by the thoughts of Bediüzzaman Said Nursi, whose writings also influenced the Gülenist movement as well. So Şule Yüksel Şener created her own style of knowing about the religious texts. This is what she claims. And also looking at some modern styles, such as Audrey Hepburn in Roman Holiday. So, but Şule Yüksel Şener, definitely, she was one of the pioneers, one of the early influencers for veiled women. On the other hand, in the following decades, her style changed enormously. Like she adopted large headscarves and long overcoats. And then for a while, she was wearing çarşaf. I cannot remember what she's wearing right now, how she covers her head recently. But she used to wear çarşaf as well, kind of çador, and covered her half of her face, nose and mouth she used to cover as well. So her style has changed throughout the 4-5 decades as well. So things are not constant, even in the religious arena, they are changing. This is in contrast to what they claim. Islamic practices, Islamic appearances change. And this is what I'm talking about in my book.
Now, of course, the headscarf was banned in a number of state and military institutions for many years. And of course, there was a notorious moment in 1999 when
Merve Kavakçı.
Yes, Merve Kavakçı. She was a Virtue Party MP. It's a kind of Islamist precursor party of the AKP. She was thrown out of parliament for wearing a headscarf to a general assembly session. And, yes. You know, you can find that footage back on YouTube, and looking back at it, it really is shocking. You know, there was a time when the headscarf was really a political flashpoint. And there's a sense, I feel, that in recent years, you know, it's not such a potent issue. It's really kind of almost feels like an issue of the past. You know, society has changed. And would you agree with that? Would you say that the headscarf is no longer such a kind of politically potent symbol? Or do you feel it's getting more or less potent now?
It's definitely less important. If you look at the main opposition party, which has been long a supporter of secularism, even the starter of the secularism, if you think about it, was Atatürk's party, which was founded by Kemal Atatürk. Even the Republican People's Party, CHP, you can see the leaders' photos or video footages with veiled women, and even the presidential candidate, Muharrem İnce, he was on the stage right before the election day with his sisters, and they all were wearing headscarves, and also his mother. So yes, it's sort of neutralized. People have understood the fact that veiling is part of everyday life, and we cannot really take this out of the public space as it was claimed, as it was desired in the past. And now we can also say more and more people do not find it problematic to have a veiled medical doctor or veiled flight attendant and so on. I think many people have accepted that a veiled woman can be also urban, educated and so on. On the other hand, yes, there are some discussions. For example, if you go to a shopping mall, you don't see any shopping mall in Istanbul, in Izmir, in Ankara, or in any other Anatolian city. You don't really see veiled women as shopping assistants. So there are still these contestations about being a veiled woman and at the same time being somehow a presentable woman, especially in the fashion sector. On the other hand, in many other arenas, for example, if you go to public office, it's become a common to see a veiled woman serving people there, working as a public officer. So things have changed. On the other hand, as some of my informants complained, either veiled or non-veiled woman, they say veiling has become a fashion. It's a trendy thing because now those modest Muslim people have the political and also social and economic power in the country. Therefore, women started adopting those styles in order to demonstrate themselves as the ones who belong to that powerful strata. Now I hear from more and more veiled women or modest Muslim people, both men and women, that veiling or Islamic appearances, let's say, have become a trendy thing.
Now, the ban on headscarves was one of the kind of dress regulations introduced in 1982 after the 1980 military coup. But it certainly wasn't the only such ban. Male civil servants and university students were banned from growing beards and sideburns or having particularly long hair.
And also moustache. There was a specific definition of the accepted moustache. But this case was missed in the discussions as well. Not only in the scholarship, but also in public discussions. Nobody considers these things. For example, even leftists have some certain mustache types in Turkey. I talked about these things in a book chapter in a different study. But this case wasn't an issue. We always discussed the ban and also Islamic appearances through observant Muslim women, but what we missed was men, observant Muslim men. This case was just missed.
It's kind of key issue really about how women's dress has generally been more politicized than men's dress, despite the fact that both have been subject to certain restrictions. And you talk in the book how conservative men have been freer to really kind of bend the rules in public. So certain kinds of religious clothing is seen as sort of optional. But for women, and the headscarf particularly, many people are much less willing to kind of bend those rules. Can you just talk about this kind of very significant gender difference that's not often remarked upon? What do you think lies behind it? Or is it just a kind of basic case of sexism, really?
I wouldn't say sexism, really, but the patriarchal structure of society. Because when you ask those, all right, veiled women, they were not allowed in the public sphere. But if you think about this patriarchal interpretations of the religion, they also say the same, women shouldn't be in the public sphere. So what the secular regime wanted, and also what the patriarchal interpretations of the religion wanted, were somehow, if not similar, if not same, they were similar, right? So women should stay at home, take care of kids, and men would be going out, earning money and bringing back home. So men would be visible in the public sphere. As you live in Istanbul, you definitely see some men wearing certain types of mustaches, and they are wearing very tight trousers and above their ankles, and they go to those hookah cafes. Some of them are observant Muslims as well, but according to Islamic rules, tight-fitting trousers should not be allowed either, because men, there are rules for men as well. They should not wear such fitting outfits, and also they should cover certain areas of their bodies. So I think more and more people started considering men's appearances as well. So this is one good thing.
I've noticed in recent months, I don't know if it's since the election, and I don't know if it's just because I'm becoming more conscious of it. There's seems to be more there's a trend of men growing the ülkücü style moustache, you know, the crescent style moustache.
Yeah, they might be wearing, I don't know. As I live in Izmir, probably I don't see much people. But Istanbul is definitely a great area to observe people, right? Izmir is more like a secular, CHP-supporting people mostly. But Istanbul is a great venue for making observations. Therefore, you might be right. I'll be in Istanbul in a few weeks. Therefore, I'll have an opportunity to see. But the ülkücü style, that's horseshoe style mustache. That might be also spreading among them, because MHP, the Nationalist Movement Party, they have formed a political alliance together with the AKP. Therefore, probably AKP people have been under the influence of the ülkücü movement, nationalist movement. And also, as you know, there is too much neo-Ottomanist influence going on in the Turkey, and ülkücü style mustache is a symbol of Turkish identity as well. And this could be a new trend.
Well, keep your eye out when you come to Istanbul. Don't know, maybe I just didn't notice it before, but it does seem like that. It's funny. And it does, I don't know any other place where clothing is so, you know, you can really reflect somebody's political opinion just based on clothing. Like, if I go back to Britain, like, that idea is completely impossible. But there's a kind of direct link, it seems, in Turkey. And one thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the book, and you mention it, actually, it's the idea that both President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his wife, Emine Erdogan, who, of course, wears a headscarf, have become these kind of style icons, really, among conservatives. You know, the Erdogan-style moustache is almost kind of du jour among people wanting to get ahead in politics. And as well, of course, there's the Czech jackets and more recently this kind of waistcoat-style cardigan that he wears. And, you know, if Erdogan wears it, they suddenly become popular. And Emine Erdogan, on the other hand, is also a real trendsetter among many conservative women.
Yes.
Could you just talk a bit about this aspect, like how the two Erdogans have become kind of style icons, really, among many in Turkey?
Erdogan, you know, he's a leader type and he's a powerful figure, especially for the AKP followers. Therefore, unquestionably, we can understand why people copy his style. And also, Emine Erdogan, she has been a style icon among not all, but several veiled women in Turkey. And for example, there was Emine Erdogan style headscarves, double-sided headscarves that are worn in a certain way. So this is also linking oneself to those who hold the power. I think this is also the case of emulation, emulating the higher ones, and also the desired identities, desired people, and also differentiating themselves from those who are wearing their scarves in a peasant style, differentiating themselves from rural people or people from lower socioeconomic strata. Therefore, we see both their styles, Emine Erdogan and Tayyip Erdogan, styles emulated by not all but good number of AKP supporter people. And Emine Erdogan, definitely there are some people helping them, some stylists helping them how to dress, how to combine them.
Really, you think Erdogan's got a stylist?
Not a stylist, but like shopping assistant, style consultant. I don't think those things were designed for him. But, you know, shopping consultant, definitely shopping assistant. I don't think he goes one by one. Even in Erdogan, okay, like last week or 2 weeks ago, I cannot remember. They were in Brussels, and Emine Erdogan got a boutique closed for herself, and she did some shopping. And I'm sure definitely there are some, even like some close friends whose tastes are good or considered good by Emine Erdogan. They are helping her out for her shopping choices and also how to combine them. But this does not necessarily mean that all visibly Muslim women or even non-observant Muslim women in Turkey find Emine Erdogan's style tasteful. Even in my social environment, like I hear from some veiled or non-veiled women how distasteful Emine Erdogan one is, and also they were making comments about Abdullah Gül's wife because she was always wearing high heels, some block heels, and even the Queen Elizabeth made fun of her when they were visiting the UK some years ago when Abdullah Gül was still in the office serving as president. So there are also harsh critics about Emine Erdogan's style as well as Hayri Nisa Gül and other AKP ladies' styles as well, but definitely there are followers as well.
That was Nazlı Alimen, many thanks to her. Don't forget you can buy her book with a hefty 30% discount if you sign up as a Turkey Book Talk member. All you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's Patreon account, along with access to that generous discount on over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history, published by IB Taurus. Membership also gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 70 conversations so far. Find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk websites, and many thanks to all current members, it's very much appreciated. Remember also to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.